Craig, you've done some significant work here on the young wives or the young ceilings issue, and I'm going to phrase it that way because there's a difference between someone you're a wife of and someone you are sealed to, at least in the LDS phase. So why don't you jump in and start us off tackling that issue?
Well, the I've read and heard a good amount of what would be called anti-Mormon literature or comments, and a lot of them have to do with accusations that Joseph Smith was a pedophile. He married a 14-year-old. He married a couple of 16-year-olds, blah, 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 blah. So that means Joseph was a pedophile. So what I want to do, just spend a minute here, to define a couple of things. So pedophilia is defined as the primary or exclusive sexual interest in prepubescent children. That automatically rules out Joseph Smith, as there is absolutely no evidence of him being sexually interested in prepubescent children. But what about marriages to teens? So here we go. Hebephilia is defined as the strong, persistent sexual interest by adults in pubescent children between the ages of 11 to 14. Ephebophilia is defined as the primary sexual interest in later adolescents, 15 up to 19. Given that Joseph Smith married more women in their 20s, 30s, etc., than he did teens, I think it's obvious that he was not fixated on teens. And therefore, while it's, you know, exciting and sensationalistic criticism of Joseph to accuse him of being a pedophile, it's just incorrect. Now, also, we have to remember that marriage to teens, if you're placing it within the historical and the cultural context of that time, marriage to teens was not uncommon. Was it were the majority of marriages to teens? No, of course not. But it was common enough that people didn't raise their eyebrows over marriages 13, 14, 15, 16 on up. So I just thought I'd mention that. I have some examples, but
well, very good, Brian. Let's move back to you and ask you to comment, if you would, on what we can find out about Joseph Smith's motivations in doing this. Because when you really just dig down to the core of all this, the real issue, the central issue for most people is, did Joseph Smith somehow have an altruistic purpose involved in these ceilings, or was he just kind of a scummy guy who was after young girls, to put it in the vernacular there? And the more that I've looked at this, the more I've come to the conclusion that he was a good guy and did have an altruistic purpose. Otherwise, he would have conducted himself far differently than he did with respect to some of the young girls. You know, the first young one that people seem to bring up often is Fanny Alger, and we could talk about her or others. But Brian, your thoughts?
Well, I think any time that we put together polygamy and religion, which are two hot button topics all by themselves, but you put them together, and you create a situation where the listener or the audience is going to almost immediately wonder, if not assume, that libido rather than religion is actually driving the process. And I think even church members, especially those who may not have known until just a few years ago that Joseph was a polygamist, because it wasn't openly taught within the church curriculum, it was found that, you know, it wasn't hard to find if you looked, but it never made it into the church curriculum. When people discover that Joseph was a polygamist, there's this fear, whether they understand it or not, that, oh my goodness, was he doing this out of libido? Did he want sex? Or is this something that the God of heaven would have actually mandated at that time and place? So when we encounter people outside of the church, we should not be surprised if they automatically assume that it was libido-driven. They have no other frame of reference. They aren't going to believe very easily that God commanded it. And so it's an uphill battle if we're trying to explain it to somebody and have them actually believe. They might understand, but to actually agree with this, that probably is not going to happen most of the time. So as we approach 14-year-olds, which is really odd by today's standard and would not be seen as acceptable socially in our culture, we have to understand that the people that are watching and listening, even church members, are just going to think that this is not right. And they're going to wonder if Joseph's desire for sex was driving it. Now, with that preface, if we look at the two 14-year-olds and the 16-year-old, I want to say, from my research, I'm confident there was no sexual relations with any of those. And I can explain why. With Helen Markhimble, she is the most well-known of the 14-year-olds. The other one might have been 15, and that was Maria Lawrence. Nancy Maria Winchester. And we don't know anything about Nancy Winchester, so if anybody says anything about it, they're just going beyond the evidence. But with respect to the 14-year-old Helen Markhimble, the story that we have shows that her father is the one who set it up, and after they were sealed, there's no account of them being together alone by in any source, in her journals, in her references later on, in Joseph's writings and things. So the idea that they were not together is important because later on when they were looking for people to testify in the Temple Lot case, Helen Markhimble lived just a few blocks from where the depositions were being taken, but they never asked her to come testify. Instead, they asked a wife from Lehi, Melissa Lott, and another wife from Lucy Walker, who came from Logan, to testify, and both of them testified that they had full relations with Joseph, that these were genuine polygamous marriages that could have resulted in children. They didn't, so far as we have any record. But the point I'm making is I'm confident that Helen and Joseph did not consummate that union, and we know nothing about Nancy Winchester. Now, the 16-year-old, Flora Ann Woodward, is interesting because she had a confrontation with Emma, and Emma was angry with her, and Joseph had given Flora Ann Woodward a gold watch, and Emma took the watch from her and stamped it under her foot, and the very next day, Flora went out and married a non-member. And then in the next few days, as near as we can tell, Joseph... Oh, let's start again.
There we are, yes. The news breaks and the commercial breaks wait for no one. So hold on there, Brian. We'll start up right after this. This is the Interpreter Show on KTalk Media. I'm Martin Tanner, your host. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we are back. This is the Interpreter Show on KTalk Media. And in studio, Alan Wyatt and Craig Foster. I'm your co-host, Martin Tanner, and with us by phone, Brian Hales. We're talking this evening about Joseph Smith and polygamy in the early LDS faith. That is really a broader topic than just that. It could be described as plural marriage or plural sealing. And before we jump back into Brian Hale's comments, I wanted to mention that the church does not shy away from this. If you go to LDS.org, there is a great article. It's called Plural Marriage in Kirtland and Nauvoo. Great little overview. It's not incredibly in-depth or detailed, but it's a wonderful overview of the topic. And this is right on the church's official website. And I bring that up because the comment is sometimes made that the church shies away from this and doesn't want any of this information known and is withholding information. And it's just not true. You can find it right here on the church's website. So with that little comment and one more comment, which is that we don't realize, because it is not the case today, that people during the early era of the church wanted to be sealed into Joseph Smith's family and Brigham Young's family, and in some cases other predominant church leaders' families. This was a great aspiration of many people. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I were a part of Joseph Smith's family in the next life? And I believe that was a big motivator involving a number of these families and some of these women as to why and what was at the heart of their desire to be sealed to Joseph Smith.
And some of the men as well. I mean, because the sealings weren't just limited male to female. They also had other sealings that took place as well.
Great point. Exceptional point. Thank you. I would have left that out. Brian, back to you.
I apologize for being so long-winded. Just a couple of more points. On Helen Mar Kimball, she was also the most prolific writer in the 19th century supporting Joseph Smith and polygamy. So she would not have seen herself, I don't think, as a victim of anything Joseph did. And then with respect to the 16-year-old Flora Ann Woodworth, she had the confrontation with Emma and then married a non-member. And as near as we can tell from some statements, that Joseph actually gave her a plural divorce. And again, I don't believe that that was a consummated marriage. I don't think she would have run off and married a non-member as quickly as she did if she'd actually consummated her sealing to Joseph. Of course, there's speculation involved there, but if people say Joseph's having sex with 14-year-olds or 16-year-olds, they're going to be well beyond the evidence, and I would personally disagree.
Great comments. We have a caller. Hi, your first name and your question or comment for our guest tonight.
Yes, R-A-Y. This is Ray. How you doing, Martin?
Great. Thanks for joining us, Ray. Your question or comment for our guests.
Yes. First, I'd like to compliment you and your guests on an outstanding, high-quality show of facts.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Yes. And okay, the second thing, in my research, and I'd like to know if the brethren, the two gentlemen, in their scholarly backgrounds and knowledge, if they found the same thing as my research. In my research, I once heard that there was 38 and 36 wives that Joseph Smith had, then it was down to 34, and I went, did it name by name, date by date, and I found out that several of them was sealed to Joseph Smith after he died, and they were of elderly age. And are you still there?
Yes, we're just...
Yes.
Are you ready for an answer to that particular question?
Yes.
Brian or Craig, go ahead. Yes. Any idea on the count? How many people how many women Joseph Smith was sealed to?
Brian, you are the man.
All right. Well, I feel like I'm talking too much, but if you look at the various lists that are out there, Fawn Brody had 48, but two of them were redundant, so she had 46. George D. Smith has 38. Todd Compton had 33. My list is 35, but my wife's list is 34. A couple of those on the 35 are on the list from a single attestation. So you have some that are very securely plural wives, and then the evidence just tapers off, and so it's very much in dispute exactly how many women were sealed to him. I also would point out that probably a third of the ones on my list were eternity-only non-sexual sealings.
Yes.
And so it just adds another color to the whole discussion. I would just also say that I'm excited because I think in the next, and maybe Craig knows, but I think that the Joseph Smith Papers Project is going to post their own list.
Yes,
and
that's what
online.
I understand. I know that I was a co-editor of the three-volume series, The Persistence of Polygamy, and in the first volume that covered plural marriage during Joseph Smith's lifetime, I was the one that prepared the appendix to that book that talked about Joseph's plural wives. And if I remember correctly, I had 34 also, Brian felt that he had found another plural wife, and I think he might be on to something. You know, and he even suggested that I put her into the into my appendix. I'm kind of kicking myself that I didn't, but it is right around there, 34, 35, I would say.
Another point that Ray brought up in his call here just a second ago is that Joseph Smith, during his lifetime, didn't just marry younger women or women that were his own age, but he also married what we would consider in that day to be elderly women as well.
Yes.
And he was sealed to them as well. He was no respecter of age when it came to fulfilling that commandment of the Lord.
Now, I am convinced that the major motivation behind most of this is the idea that's found in the LDS faith of family relationships continuing on beyond this life. Because certainly a relationship, whether platonic or not in this life, could not have been his major motivating factor. He was just doing too many other things. And frankly, despite a number of the claims that Joseph Smith was so-and-so's father, DNA testing has failed to substantiate that in every single case, although there was one where it was inconclusive. But there has been no one, as far as I know. Craig, maybe you have more updated information.
Even the inconclusive one who was, and Brian, you'll have to help me. I'm trying to remember her name. Ugo Perrigo did DNA research and was able to narrow it down. Every year, DNA research is progressing by leaps and bounds, and he now, Josephine Fisher, he now feels strongly that that Josephine Fisher was not Joseph Smith's daughter. So
DNA has excluded everyone.
DNA has now excluded her. The only possibility would be Olive Frost, if I remember correctly, had a son, and both she and her son died at winter quarters. So there's a possibility, but we will never know.
We will never know.
Well, am I correct on that, Brian?
Yeah, except on the Olive Frost, the source for that actually was made available after my books came out, and the source gives a timeline that Joseph could not have been the father of Olive's child.
Uh-huh.
It would have had to have been Brigham Young, to whom she was sealed to after Joseph's death.
Right.
So I've taken her child completely off of my list, even though originally she and Josephine were two highly possible ones that I had accumulated. Again, just showing how the data continues to come in, and gratefully, virtually everything that's come out since my books did 5 years ago, I think, supports the conclusions that were drawn in the books. Maybe the one exception was that I actually thought Josephine would be Joseph's daughter, and the DNA is conclusive. I've talked to Ugo about this several times, that it is now conclusive. Josephine is not the daughter of Joseph Smith, and that was a huge thing. It wasn't what I expected, but it was what I had hoped.
Interesting. Ray, any further comments or questions?
Yes. Also, you do. No one commented on the dates of the 34 or all the ones that are claimed. Several of those dates are after Joseph Smith died. Of some of those people that was sealed to Joseph Smith. Did either of you find that? As I did in my research.
I think, and Brian would probably know even better than I, but I think that there's enough evidence based on diary and journal entries that the women, the 34 to 35 women, I think it's pretty conclusive. Now, you have to keep in mind that these women were later sealed to Joseph after his death. They were sealed in the temple. Sealings were done beforehand. They were married to Joseph Smith in the Red Brick Store or at other places. But once the temple was constructed, they went and they were sealed again with people like Brigham Young acting as proxy for Joseph Smith so that it could be recorded in the temple records. And some people might think, oh, that means that they weren't married to Joseph, you know, before that time. They were.
So a little bit like baptisms for the dead. Some were done in the river and then later in the temple again.
Then they had to redo them in the temple. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then the last point is there's been a lot of DNA research of people who claim to be descendants of Joseph Smith, and out of all the DNA tests, none has come out positive.
Right.
Descendants of Joseph Smith. And he was very fertile. I think, did he have like 10 children with Emma? I can't remember. A lot of them died.
He fathered a number of children. I can't remember offhand, but yes, there were a good handful of children.
The point is that he was capable of doing so.
Yes. Capable of having children, yes, and although most of them died in infancy, yes.
Yeah.
Anything else, Ray?
No, that's fine. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. Great call. And that frees up a line if you'd like to join us. Our topic today, and we have some of the genuine experts on this subject, is polygamy. If you'd like to call us, our call-in number is 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. This is the Interpreter Show on KTalk, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which you can find on the internet and which defends the LDS faith and has scholarly articles, podcasts, and scripture roundtables for those of you who are teaching gospel doctrine class and a number of other different offerings. And I'll let Alan mention
that
a little bit more about the website.
No, that piques my memory here, something that I should bring up. For those of you who are following the gospel doctrine course of study this year, if you go to interpreterfoundation.org, you'll find front and center on the homepage of the website a link that says Study Gospel Doctrine. And if you go to that, you'll find a ton of resources that follows along with the course of study that we're following in Gospel Doctrine this year, which happens to be about the Old Testament.
I'm a Gospel Doctrine teacher in my ward, and I can tell you, that is indispensable. It is fantastic. Each lesson, I get the material that they have, and I read through that because there's just so much fantastic information there.
And this is just a resource that we've just made available within the last couple of weeks. So if you have not been to the website in a while, you'll want to go to interpreterfoundation.org and check out that resource that's there. No charge for it. It's available to anybody who's interested in the Gospel Doctrine course of study.
Although Interpreter takes donations.
We do take donations. I would be remiss if I didn't say, yes, we do take donations.
We have another caller. You are on the air. Your first name and your question or comment. Hello.
Am I? Okay. Yeah, my name's Dean.
Dean, thanks for calling. Your question or comment.
Anyway, I don't think this, I don't think the world or the Mormons will ever understand this polygamy deal. And it's kind of, you know, it's almost a waste of time arguing about it in a way, because who knows where the mind of the Lord, and he said in that law that it was going to change from time to time. And so, who knows. But anyway, this is a little bit off the topic, but I'll make it really quick. You guys are interpreters. Who interprets dreams and visions now?
You know, interpreting dreams and visions, really not something that we...
our website. Yeah, we'll leave that up to Daniel.
Let me go back 20 years and tell you what.
Okay.
I had a dream in 96. And anyway, I came to that place in May of 99 and seen where it was. This dream was taking place. I'd remembered it like the back of my hand. Anyway, so I barged into Hugh Nibley's office and talked to him about it. And anyway,
I bet Hugh was pleased with that.
Yeah, I had his attention. But I says, well, what do I do with this? You know, well, I don't know. I says, I can't really walk into the prophet's office. And I, you know, I just had this dream today. Either that or some bad chicken. And anyway, so he says, I don't know, but the word will get out. But he says, what you got to do is write this down. Well, I didn't think what he meant at the time because I was pretty naive at the time. But anyway, I went back and dropped it off. He wasn't there in his office. I don't know what's happened. But since then, all this stuff has happened to me. And I've got basically the keys to unlock the prisoners down to where the dream was at the Utah County Security Center, they call it. It's a prison.
So
anyway,
one
of you guys is a lawyer, aren't you?
And there's our music. We need to take our break, but it sounds like, caller, you have at least had the opportunity to have some kind of a dream that meant something in your future. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back. This is the Interpreter Show on KTalk. I'm Martin Tanner, your host. We'll be right back. We are back. Boy, I love that religious bumper music there. That's great. I'm not sure. Anyway, fun stuff. Actually, that's a little lively. I enjoyed that. We have another call. Caller, your first name and your question or comment for our guest tonight. Thanks for joining us. Hello.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Hey, Martin.
Hi.
And guest. Just an observation about some of the parallels between different critics and early Christianity. A lot of modern anti-Mormon critics will say, how can you believe in Joseph Smith as a prophet when he was arrested many times, was into black magic, got people to put on magical underwear, believe in extra-biblical texts, was a schemer, God-maker, had a vision of Jesus and conflicting visions of accounts. But I would ask, well, but how can critics believe then in those that made the Nicene Creed? We are supposed to believe in, that's supposed to be the real Jesus. Constantine, and here's the parallels. Constantine also had a vision of Jesus, and there's different conflicting accounts on that. He was a God maker, enforced extra biblical doctrines, had people wear white garments, and was a murderer, schemer, pagan, cult member.
Well, I'm not sure how close of a parallel we want to make between Constantine and the LDS Church, but your point is well taken, and that is that the LDS Church is not often criticized in an even-handed manner. That what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. We have critics who don't apply the same standards to their own faith that they apply when criticizing Latter-day Saints.
Right, and let me just further illustrate this. Athanasius, who took part in the Nicene Creed era, he was a God-maker. He talked about the Word of God became a man, so you can learn from a man how to become God. He complained about even the Nicene Creed formula was extra-biblical doctrine. And he was accused of black magic and murder. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the severed hand mystery. Apparently in 335 AD, Bishop Arcinian came up missing, so Athanasius was accused of hacking off his hand for black magic rites. His rivals accused him of kidnapping, murder, sacrilege, Satanism, extortion, and Athanasius was summoned to face the charges. And he brought the guy that supposedly had been murdered and had him in a, from the head down, a cloak that covered up his hands. And there was the tribunal passed around a box with the severed hand. Here's the evidence. And then so Athanasius had the guy stick out his hand, this hand, and then he went to the other side and said, extended the other hand, meaning this hand, and from there on the whole case fell apart. But I hope you've noted the parallels that I'm talking about.
There are some inappropriate accusations made in the early Christian days and with the LDS faith. Thank you. Thanks for that sharing. Appreciate that. Brian, we, I think, took our break a bit ago, and you were kind of in the middle of a thought that we never quite got back to, if I remember. If you still want to go there, great, and if you have some other thoughts on polygamy in our last 15 minutes or so of our program, jump right in.
Well, I did think that the gentleman who was talking about the timeline for some of the marriages, the sealing ceremonies, he said some of them were after Joseph Smith's death, and Craig, and I think, Alan, I don't know, one of you mentioned that the timeline for the 34 or 35 is pretty good. Actually, we've got several of those without an actual date, but there's other evidence supporting it. But it was also interesting that when they opened the Nauvoo Temple, that if a woman could approach Brigham Young, who was in charge of the Sealings then, and if she could convince him that Joseph had proposed to her, that then that woman could be sealed to him by proxy. He wasn't allowing just any woman to come along, but there were at least three or four women who Joseph had talked to and proposed to them. They turned him down, and he didn't destroy their reputation. He didn't tell anyone. The only reason we know about it is because the women came forth later and mentioned it to Brigham. See, these women were also allowed to be sealed to Joseph. So I just wondered if perhaps this gentleman had been hearing about those sealings, which came afterwards by proxy rather than during Joseph's lifetime.
That's a great point, a great possibility. And Craig, you also had a point that I didn't want our show to neglect here about, especially the idea of the prevalence of young marriages during time gone by. In our era, we often make the mistake of judging everything by our own contemporary standards.
That's called presentism.
Yes, and yes. We often do that in all kinds of aspects. I mean, you know, this will date me a little bit, but when I was married in the late 1970s, it was not unusual for people to get married out of high school or in their early 20s. And I think the average marriage age now in the United States is in the late 20s. So even just in those few decades, the shift has been quite dramatic. And the shift from then to the Joseph Smith's time, which was a much larger gap, was pretty significant as well. But Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention that there's a book by Nicholas Siret titled American Child Bride, A History of Minors and Marriage in the United States, where he talks about the fact that back in the 19th century, for most of American history, there was no distinction between the marriage of two minors or that between one party who was older, sometimes considerably so, and one who was younger. And he went on to say that marrying at the age of 14 was not at all uncommon throughout the nation in the middle of the 19th century. And I wanted to say, you know, that I've read comments and I've heard comments that people have made where they refer to these to some of the young women that Joseph married as little children or victims, and these women, these young women, would have been offended by that because the thought back then was, if they felt they were old enough, then they were old enough to marry. There was an example.
It's funny today, Craig. You know, you have 4 and 5 year olds who are somehow in Europe and in a few places in the U.S. old enough to decide that they're really a boy if they were born a girl, or really a girl if they were biologically born a boy. But oh my word, marry someone under the age of 16 or 18, that you just don't have the capacity. And I just find some irony there.
Great, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I have gone through a number of different memoirs, journals, and things. My background is I'm a professional genealogist, and when I first started hearing people going on about, oh, Joseph was a pedophile, blah, 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 I thought, oh, for heaven's sake, I have seen so many marriage entries of these younger women. And here's one, you know, in Oregon, in the Willamette Valley.
And these are not Latter-day Saint
these
marriages.
These are not Latter-day Saints.
Just to make that clear.
This woman, she later recalled, I was nearly 15 years old, and I thought it was high time that I got married. So she accepted a proposal. I know that in my own ancestry, they were French-Canadian Catholics. I have two ancestors who were 13 years old when they got married, and a number of other ancestors, 15, 16, etc. This was much more prevalent than people realize, and they were not victims. They considered themselves adults old enough to marry.
It was something that happened at that time, in that culture.
At that time, in that culture. It changed near the end of the 19th century, started changing. But previous to that, there was no, you know, hard line on what was who was an adult and who wasn't.
We have another caller. Your name and your question or comment, please.
I'm sorry, Martin. It's Ray again. Just two quick points.
Very quickly.
Okay. One, back in the pioneer days, at 12 and 13, these children were very mature. I mean, they could run a farm, and they could run a household. And it's not like children today in their 20s. Some of them don't even hold jobs. And then the second quick point is I once did a research of the marrying age back in the 1800s in the different states. And I found out that in most of the states it was legal to marry at 13, some 14, and I even think one was 12, and I can't remember off the top of my head.
Craig would know that. Go ahead. Thank you for joining us. Craig, go ahead.
That was based on English common law. Age 12 was the minimum age for a female, age 14 for a male. And English common law, which, like I said, the states accepted that even after we had our independence, they just went based on English common law. English common law was based on canon law. So in the church, that was the Catholic Church, that was the accepted age, 12 for a girl, 14 for a boy, and that was based on Roman law. So this goes back a very long time.
Well, throughout history, the typical idea was that once you were capable of having children, you were marriageable.
Exactly.
And the life expectancy being
what it was,
quite a bit younger, that you wanted to have posterity and children who could help you at whatever vocation the family was involved in at a young age, because that was economically advantageous.
Yep.
And so
absolutely,
that was the norm. Brian, I assume you're still with us, unless 911 got a call or
yes,
in touch with you. But any parting comments during the last few minutes of our program here about polygamy? Some point that we may not have mentioned.
You know, from a personal standpoint, we meet with people, my wife and I, who have questions, and one concern I have regarding some of them is that they become almost allergic to what they call apologists, and of course I've been called that many times, and usually in a pejorative way, but the thing that they don't seem to realize is that they are embracing propagandists, and they have many questions and doubts for the apologist, as they label us, but they embrace with open arms the propagandist who is telling them things about Joseph and polygamy that are not accurate. They're misrepresentations, they are half-truths, or just outright falsehoods. And the antidote for that with polygamy or anything, I think, is that we need transparency. And you earlier mentioned the Gospel Topics essay, which it covers every one of the controversies. There's nothing held back. And the church, as Elder Oaks said when they reformed the first presidency, the church is being transparent. It's putting terabytes of data available for people to scrutinize with the belief that our history can withstand scrutiny, that the church's doctrines and everything can withstand it. And so I just encourage us all to get rid of the labels apologist or propagandist, but just get more knowledge. If we're having questions, the antidote for these doubts is more knowledge, and not to be duped by propagandists, and you don't have to believe the apologist. Just get the information for yourself.
It is up to you, and it was kind of fun for me to learn many years ago that the greatest repository in the world of information and anti-Mormon and critical literature is in the church archives. the church's library actually does that. The church really is quite transparent. And I guess that about does it for us. Brian Hales, Craig Foster, Alan Wyatt, it's just been a pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
Thanks, Brian. I'm Martin Tanner. This is The Interpreter Show. We'll be back next week. Please join us then.